As I set out toward the river, I seemed to myself to be nearly weightless. I felt reborn. I felt full of energy and bursting with good health and vitality. Over a period of a few minutes, I had passed from weary, disgruntled skeptic to ecstatic believer. Looking back on it, I believe that for me this was the critical juncture. Why did I not question Dennis more closely? Was I somehow self-hypnotized? Did the unfamiliar setting, the restricted diet, strain, and expectations push me into a place where I was unable to resist participation of a sort in the world of my brother's bizarre ideation? Why was I unable to maintain my detached and skeptical viewpoint? In some sense, this willing suspension of disbelief is the crux of the matter, and, I believe, of many a close encounter situation. The other plays with us and approaches us through the imagination, and then a critical juncture is reached. To go beyond this juncture requires abandonment of will and habit. At that moment, the world turns lazily inside out, and what was hidden is revealed, a magical modality, a different epigenetic landscape than one has known, a landscape become real. The UFO is a creature of this previously invisible landscape. It is lord of the skies of the imagination, able to carry anyone with it who will but play, and then let the play deepen and deepen. As I walked along that perfect morning, no such soothingly objective thoughts came to me. Instead, I assumed that my body was metabolizing its way toward the resurrection body that we had expected to be part of the success of the experiment. I did not know what was happening in the world or far away, but I did know that since the moment Dennis had pronounced the experiment finished, I had felt an expanding and ever-increasing wave of energy and understanding unfold through my being. As I walked along, what seemed to me then a profound realization came over me. It was that we are all enlightened beings, that only our inability to see and feel ourselves and others as we really are keeps us from shedding our guilt and seeing ourselves as enlightened. I felt very good. I felt better than I had ever felt before, but I couldn't believe what seemed to be happening. It was about a 10 or 15 minute walk to Dave and Vanessa's place. By now it was about 7 a.m. The sun was well up in the sky, and it was a beautiful day. As I walked across the pasture, I would stop and say, "Dennis," and the response was instantaneous. It was just like thought. It confused me. I kept stopping and doing this, sitting down on the grass. "Is it all right? What is it? I don't know. I can't understand what it means." I walked on toward the river. As I walked along, I did some experiments. I said, "Terence, Terence." It was very much like talking to yourself. Then I said, "Dennis," and the thing was instantly there, just ready to do business. Then I said, "McKenna, McKenna," and it was still there. I realized that I couldn't reach it with my first name, but I could reach it with my last name. I could not understand what was going on. I was pondering these kinds of things when I arrived at the riverside house of Vanessa and Dave. They were still in their hammocks asleep, but crowded around the door, even this early in the morning, were a group of wide-eyed Witoto children. As I pushed my way through them, my gaze fell on each, and I thought, "You are enlightened, and you, and you." My arrival was the first event of the day for Dave and Vanessa. I told them that we had succeeded, that success was not a condensed hyper-object, but a teaching. I asked them to dress and come with me. While they were gathering their hammocks, they told me that during the darkest part of the night, Dave had awakened, hysterical, in a state not unlike the condition induced in him by the electrical storm the evening before. They had been very agitated during the night and could only attribute this to what we had been doing. I was interested in all of this, but seemed to hear it as from a long distance. I wanted to return to the forest and see what else would unfold. In my mind, I was recalling something else Dennis had said a few minutes before in the pasture. He had said that the demarcation between day and night, the dawn line, was now making a 24-hour sweep around the world, a sweep that began at the dawn moment when the experiment at La Churera was finished. Throughout the world, traffic and factories were coming to a halt. People were standing around and realizing that someone, somewhere, had broken through, that this was not a day like any other day. Dave and Vanessa followed me back to the forest, grumbling a good part of the way. When we had gone slightly past the place where I had parted from Dennis, we came upon something which could not at first be fitted into any set of expectations. This was Dennis' Ruana and shirt discarded in the middle of the path. Next came a pair of pants, and then further on two sweat socks, and, though I was to learn this only later, his glasses and his boots had also been hurled away. Following this trail of cast-off garments led us back to the hut in the forest. There we found Ev and Dennis, both naked and sitting on the floor of the hut, discussing and doing the Ask Dennis meditation. With the comment that you cannot receive a proper initiation unless you are naked, Dennis insisted that we take off our clothes. Vanessa peeled, and Dave and I followed her example. The presence of the mushroom was there, and it seemed to be saying, "Take off your clothes. Throw everything away. Everything is breaking. All objects are no good to you now. Throw everything away. You do not need it anymore." We all looked at each other, glossy pubic hair and secret genitals now in the sunshine. I rolled a joint then. We sat in a circle and smoked. We told Dave and Vanessa about the teaching and urged them to try it with varying degrees of success, since a voice in the head is a very subjective thing. If one has it, there is no doubt. If one does not have it, it seems a very murky thing. Everything was very amicable, except that Dennis was showing a tendency to talk right through other people's comments, as if they were not present. It was as though he were on a different time track from the rest of us, since he really seemed unable to realize that someone else was talking. We thought that it was logical to untie our hammocks from the house and take nothing but our hammocks and go naked into the jungle, tie the hammocks in a tree, and then get into these hammocks. We would then explore the mode, because clearly you could do more than ask or answer questions. The door was standing open. God alone knew what one could do. I asked the thing in my mind what should be done, and had received instruction that we should visually meditate on our lives, and, starting from the present, trace back through our entire life, encountering and setting things right with every sentient creature that we had ever wronged. When we reached the end of this process, we would leave our bodies and be somehow free in the dimension of absolute freedom that seems so near. Lying in our hammocks, we set out to meditate our way to hyperspace. I could see myself at La Chorrera, then going down the trail to El Encanto, up the river to Leguizamo, and back to Bogota, back to Canada, and at each point I would meet the people that I had lived my life with, and I would say, "We got it! I'm sorry, I hope I didn't offend you too much back there in 3D. It's all over now, it's all over." I could see people. Immediately I reached out for all of them. I seemed to be able to reach them. "We're in the Amazon," I explained to each, "and now we're going home, or someplace." The vision had an utterly bizarre quality. Tears welled up behind my closed eyelids. It was very peculiar. The voice of the teacher spoke in my head. "You found it. This is it. It's all over now. There is no more. Within a few hours, the superstructure of human civilization is going to collapse, and your species is going to go to Jupiter and then to the stars. A day of high adventure dawns for man at last." Images welling up behind closed eyes seemed to be deepening and growing more intense, but after an hour it was clear that they were actually fading. One by one, we pulled ourselves out of the stupor that the morning heat and being in the hammock had induced. We were talking and talking, analyzing and analyzing. Dennis seemed most out of it. Dave and Vanessa, uncertain that anything at all had really happened, was distant, and I was feeling definitely immersed in the surreal perception that had been mine since the chaotic opening of the day. Something was wrong. Expectation was outrunning reality. Nothing had happened. It came out that no one could hear Dennis in their mind, except me. They were all actually wondering what was going on. We had entered the next phase, which was a period of confusion for all. Dennis was disengaging from reality. I would talk to him, and he didn't know anyone was speaking to him. He was still breaking into conversations because he didn't know anyone else was speaking. A visit to the priest's outdoor shower was suggested and seized upon, since we were all filthy and covered with the grime of fire tending. We gathered up our scattered clothing, and during this effort it came out that Dennis had thrown his glasses away, along with his boots and everything else. Disheveled and disoriented, we set off, searching unsuccessfully for the lost pair of glasses as we retraced our path to the mission. We were a group of people of many minds about the previous several hours, some assuming that this was a day like any other, others assuming that this was the first day of the age at the end of time. A group of Witoto gazed at us as we passed and then roared with appreciative laughter. They know what has been achieved, the voice in my head assured me. They were certainly beaming and chortling about something. On we walked toward the mission and its shower in the sunshine. Dennis would not stop talking. The consensus was building that we had a crisis on our hands, but it wasn't yet out of control. We agreed that Yahe is very peculiar and thought that the passage of a few hours would smooth everything out. That was everyone's conclusion except Dennis and my own. It was no longer really possible to communicate with Dennis. My conclusion was that something had happened, that he had done something, that some kind of odd principle had been manipulated. But it wasn't as we thought it was, and so we were cast we knew not where. I was calm. I was at least participating in the social situation. Even though there were tears of joy streaming down my face, I wasn't out of touch with reality. I said, "We'll wait for tomorrow. Dennis will come down." Everyone seemed to be finding their way back to their normal psychic equilibrium, save Dennis and myself. I was burdened with odd but wonderfully expanded perceptions, while his wandering ideas and wild eyes indicated that he was having some difficulty in getting his feet on the ground. After our shower and on the way back to the forest, I mentioned all of these things to him, but he replied in riddles and with mimicry of dead relatives so that I could get nothing out of him. I continued to assume that a night's sleep would set him right. I insisted that he rest in his hammock when we returned to the camp, which he did while the rest of us set things in order. Chapter 12, In the Vortex. It was decided that Vanessa and Dave would stay the night at our hut, so their two hammocks were left hanging along with our three. It was a crowded situation. We dined well that evening, and except for the occasional oblique or plain incomprehensible comment from Dennis, the surface of things seemed to be restored. Vanessa's ankle remained bad, and much attention was directed toward this difficulty, almost in tribute to its being so palpable in contrast to most of what was going on. I felt utterly changed and made new, removed from everyone and content to let events unfold as they would, assured by the new thing inside of me that however things appeared, all was very, very well. The last rave of this long, amazing day came after dinner in the firelight, when from his hammock, Dennis broke the silence to explain that this night in our dreams, we would learn a series of things that would end with us severing our connection to our bodies long before morning. We would reassemble in our perfected astral forms on the bridge of a starship that was in geosynchronous orbit 22,000 miles above the Amazon basin. This was the second of the self-limiting prophecies that had been made since the experiment. The first had been the effort to meditate backward to one's birth attempted that morning. In retrospect, I now see that this eschatological hysteria was one of the chief ways in which my thinking seemed radically different. Over the next weeks and years, there would be many more of these self-testing prophecies, many scenarios of the possible way the world might undergo eschatological transformation. 4 days from the experiment, 5, 7, 10, 16, 21, 40, 64, all were times awaited with hope and willful suspension of disbelief, and all came and went with the eschaton still all-pervading, still very elusive. The idea of a dimension-roving lens vehicle, once articulated, was never far away. His statement was also the first appearance of the UFO image in Dennis' thought since the experiment, a theme to be articulated in a thousand ways in the days that were to follow. The equation Lapis equals self equals UFO was the operating assumption of Dennis' long voyage of self-discovery and return. With these images of death in sleep and rebirth inside the starship ringing in our minds, we turned in, thoroughly exhausted. Uh, I stressed that the hut was crowded with hammocks strung from every available beam. It was difficult to move about without communicating that to one's neighbors through the tugging and twisting of the many ropes. We must have retired about 10 o'clock. I slept soundly until sometime many hours later that I took to be 2 or so. I rose to take the traditional middle-of-the-night piss that the use of condensed milk induces in the explorer. I sat up in my hammock, struggled for matches, and then lit a candle. In the silent night, I heard the inrush of my own exclamation of amazement. An intense triple-layered corona of light was shimmering out from the candle flame for a distance of about 4 feet. It was an intense iridescent blue alternating with an equally pure orange. I was immediately reminded of the aura of light that surrounds the body of the resurrected Christ in the painting of that subject by Matthias Gruenwald. I understood that he must have seen the same thing that I was seeing now, and later incorporated it into his resurrection. Simultaneously, as though I was having a yet deeper thought, I somehow intuitively understood that the distortion or polarizing of the light of the flame that I was seeing was an effect caused by the distortion of psychic space-time induced by our experiment and the nearby presence of the lapis. This thought was followed by another. Perhaps the temporal and spatial distance from the stone could be gauged by the intensity of the colors in the aura of light around a simple candle. The distortion from light from a candle to act as a detector of the philosopher's stone. I thought of Diogenes prospecting for the good. Was that what he was doing? I thought of the phrase, "It is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness," and I laughed. I awakened Eve, and she sleepily confirmed the colors around the candle, but it communicated nothing to her of what it communicated to me. She rolled over, and when I returned from going outside, she was snoring softly. As I climbed back to my hammock, I counted heads and noticed that everyone was present and seemingly completely asleep. I lay awake a long time, thinking. All seemed still. As breakfast unfolded the following morning, the 6th of March, it became clear that the restful sleep I had imagined we had all shared the night before had been anything but that. From Dennis, still disorganized but ample comments, it emerged that he had, or imagined he had, a very active night. Closely questioned, it came out that he was completely convinced that sometime during the night he had arisen and dressed, and then had a series of nocturnal adventures that involved going alone in the darkness to the thundering immensity of the Choro over a mile away, then returning to climb and spend some time in a large tree near the edge of a mission before making his way back across the pasture and returning to his hammock strung among all the others. The thought of him wandering around during the night on those trails without his glasses, falling in and out of shamanic ecstasy, perhaps howling and otherwise paleolithically comporting himself, was too much for me. It was a breach of the collective cool, and even though I was 90% certain that it had never really happened, I was determined to eliminate all possibility of such rambles in the future. Dennis' story was an amazing description of a shamanic night journey. He said he had gone to the Choro and meditated in the mission cemetery we had visited before. He had begun to return to camp when he confronted a particularly large Mauritius tree near where the path skirted the edge of the mission. On impulse, he had climbed it, not at all unaware that the ascent of the world tree is the central motif of Siberian shamanic journeying. As he climbed the tree, he felt the flickering polarities of many archetypes, and finally, as he reached the highest point in his ascent, something which he called the vortex opened ahead of him, like a swirling enormous doorway into time. He could see the cyclopean megaliths of Stonehenge, and beyond those ringed stones, revolving at a different speed than a higher plane, the outline of the pyramids, marble-faceted and gleaming as they have not done since the days of pharaonic Egypt, and yet further into the turbulent maw of the vortex he saw, to mysteries ancient long before the advent of man, titanic, archetypal forms on worlds unimagined by us, the arcane machineries of sentient agencies that swept through this part of the galaxy when our planet was young and its surface barely cooled. This machinery, these gibbering abysses touched with the cold of interstellar space and eon-consuming time, rushed down upon him. He fainted, and time, who can say how much time, passed by him. He next found himself in the pasture, a few hundred feet from his newly discovered Axis Mundi. If he fell from the tree, it did not seem to have hurt him. Amazement, exultation, fear, and confusion were all present in his thoughts. The continuum seemed to be shredding and ripping itself to pieces before his eyes. Time and space swirling the artifacts of 20,000 years of human striving into a vortex of apocalyptic contradictions. In that state of fear and exultation in the depth of man's destiny among the stars, Dennis returned to our camp and noiselessly returned to his hammock, or awakened there from a dream of the same thing. 24 hours had passed since the attempt to hypercarbolate human DNA. It was apparent that Dennis was not pulling out of the induced state of shamanic excitement as quickly as we had anticipated. Two choices presented themselves to explain the situation. The strain of the journey and the recent psilocybin tripping had contributed to activate a shamanic archetype in Dennis that had been latent all along, but which was now overt and carrying a strong transference potential to which I was succumbing by being unable to recognize my brother's condition as a potentially pathological state. This was the position that Vanessa and Dave leaned toward, and was the source of much of our difference of opinion on how to proceed. A second explanation takes a biochemical rather than a psychological approach. It says that Dennis had, through his unusual diet of drugs and the experiment he performed, inhibited some enzyme system that would normally return one from the heights of a hallucinogenic trip, but in this case had somehow become inoperative. The most likely candidate for this would be the MAO, monoamine oxidase system, which is responsible for rendering many hallucinogens into inoperative byproducts. The phenomenon of irreversible MAO inhibition is known to occur with some drugs, and is a condition that takes nearly 2 weeks to correct itself. However, the compounds in Banisteriopsis copy are known to usually reverse their MAO inhibition in 4 to 6 hours. Nevertheless, as subsequent events showed, this explanation is doubtless some part of the true story. After years of thought, my own explanation continues to lean heavily on the second idea for an operational explanation. I do not believe that Dennis was predisposed to an archetypal submergence. I believe that he did, in a single moment, somehow bind all the MAO in his body, and that his long derangement was due to the lag time that was required to rebuild his MAO level from a complete and sudden depletion. I believe that this sudden depletion was caused by his experiment, and that vocally induced resonance canceling of the forces that normally operate in these molecules caused major changes in his body chemistry. In short, I believe that he induced an irreversible MAO inhibition in his body through the use of psilocybin and his voice and will. If this is true, then the implication for humanity may be every bit as great as we in our inflated state of mind supposed, since it hints at a means by which mankind might explore the parallel continuum whose interaction with our own existence is signified by the visionary experience. It may well be the effect that is the crack in a door that, once flung open, will lead us to all the worlds teeming in our dreams and imaginations. It is an effect to be studied and learned from. Today, years after the experiment, it still seems full of great promise. My continued interest in these matters is based on the personal belief that some unusual and still unconfirmed effect was at work in our experiment, something like the principle of resonance canceling that Dennis was so intrigued by. Breakfast of the second day following the experiment was closed with a hot discussion of whether Dennis had really gone to the Choro or only dreamed that he had done so. As the rhetoric exhausted itself, Vanessa drew me away from the hut and walked along with me as I went to the spring for water. We were to have a talk, the gist of which was that, since there were wide differences in diagnosis of what was going on, so there were wide differences concerning what should be done. But since Dennis is your brother and you have strong opinions on the subject, I will defer in favor of what you think should be done here, at least for the moment. I was grateful for the margin of time contained in Vanessa's chosen course. The whole question revolving around Dennis's state of mind concerned how and especially when he would pull out of it. Any theory had to come forth with an operational prediction on that vital point. I understood from Vanessa's demeanor that we should be pretty much to ourselves in the forest house. We could expect her and Dave only as visitors, and already the possibility of retreat from the jungle isolation was being announced as a faint but growing theme. It all fell into place from the second day onward. Ev became a kind of liaison with the rest of the world of La Chorrera. She arrived in the late afternoon and departed each morning, cooking an evening and morning meal and being very game about it all, considering that she had only fallen in with our little group 3 weeks before. And thus was the stage set for the next 5 days, from the 5th to the 10th of March, the chaos at La Chorrera. During this time, Dennis very slowly got better. He became more coherent. He said that the experience had catapulted him to the edge of the Riemannian topology of the universe, that he had to come back in, and that he was regressing inward through level after level after level. Very strange things went on during this period. He could hear my mind working. He was telepathic, there was no doubt about it. He could do perfect voice imitations of our mother and father. He became all these people, doing it perfectly. And there was much more, a vision of 20th century history, building the lens, and the end of time. He said that the discovery of a higher physical dimension was ahead of us a few years in time, but somehow linked up to Egypt, to acacia tryptamine cults, to Tibet 8,000 years ago, to Punpo shamanic magic, all these ideas in constant circulation, and he talked and performed constantly. No notes exist from that period, so filled was I with the assumption that we were abiding in eternity that I felt no need to write at all. As the world seemed to me to grow more perfect, I determined at some point I would write a poem, but that moment never came. Nothing is coherent or connected from those 5 days. I remember that they were the most intense times that I have ever gone through, and that there was not an emotional or intellectual chord in the human register that was not rung again and again in 1,000 variations. In the notes made week after those times, I could only summarize those 5 days by labeling them absurdly fire, water, earth, man, peace. I sat and Dennis raved. Without his glasses, his eyes were wild and unsettling to look into. Since the night of his contested shamanic ramble, I had formed the intention not to sleep, but to stand watch constantly, day and night. For the next 9 days, I neither slept nor needed sleep, though I know that such cases are on record. For years after the experience, the lack of a need for sleep for 9 days, which I personally underwent, seemed to me the most solid argument for the reality of the forces that we experimented with. For I did not merely not need to sleep, but was constantly thinking in a rich, calm, image-filled way that made my normal thought process seem a pale and jerkily animated shadow of the mental power that I felt throughout the sleepless period and long afterward. The time that we were moving through seemed made of the reflections of what had preceded it and what was to follow. The first night that followed upon my decision not to sleep was passed in deep reverie and a growing amazement that I was actually functioning without any apparent need of sleep. In the last of the darkness before dawn, at a time that I felt was exactly the time when we had performed the experiment 2 days before, I heard Dennis stir in his hammock inside the hut. Then I heard, low but strong and clear, the same ululating howl that had catapulted us into a new world 48 hours before. Three times it sounded, just as something in my mind assured me that it would. The last howl was drawn out as before. It rose and fell for perhaps a minute. As it faded away, I again heard the cock crow drifting across the whitening air from the mission. Why did these things happen with such symmetry, as though a huge, ordered form was trying to surface in the very organization of the reality around us? Sunrise flamed across the sky, and another of those titanic days began. The thing in my mind stirring to meet the challenge to reason that each new moment seemed charged with. All that remains of those times are images and incidents, only metaphors acted as sustained themes. All was myth-making and image-making, mercurial, meta-leveled, ever-flowing. Chapter 13, At Play in the Fields of the Lord. Ev returned with Dave and Vanessa to the river that morning, and for the first time in 2 days, Dennis and I were alone, and the atmosphere was one of calm. I busied myself sorting through and arranging the equipment. Our campsite was again spick and span. Dennis was alternately calm or into long harangues on a supracosmic scale, a la the Star Maker of Olaf Stapleton. He imitated, personified, described, and otherwise invoked immense Gnostic and Manichaean entities that were struggling on a cosmic scale, but not without
like
humor, occasionally moaning
dying.
Out that he felt like an old man dying. Then he would collapse with laughter at this cleverness. I sat in my hammock and verbally participated as much as I could in all of this, though it was clear that Dennis had no difficulty in maintaining a conversation on his own. In fact, he seemed to have hit the main vein of the fountain of sprung verse. I closed my eyes for a moment, and there, fully formed beneath my eyelids, was the first of what I call teachings or messages. It was a beautiful recursive geometric form. The voice in my mind informed me that this was the Valentine curve. Obviously, the four petals of the curve looked somewhat like a valentine or a bleeding heart. I thought for an instant of the heart-shaped fruit I had fashioned into a water pipe. No obvious connection. The image slid. I went and got my notebook and drew the Valentine curve, at first crudely, later much more smoothly. It made me think of Basil Valentine, an alchemist, author of The Triumphal Chariot of Antinomy. I had read the book, but could remember virtually nothing about it. I thought, too, of Valentinian, Alexandrian Gnostic of the second century, and his doctrine that the material world was the condensed emotion of the errant Sophia, who had selfishly created a universe without undergoing any union but with herself. The condensation of emotion into matter, the theme was hair-raising. It was the theme that had brought us to the Amazon, and alchemy was the gnosis of material transformation. Clues seemed everywhere. Everything was webbed together in a magical fabric of meaning and affirmation and mystery. And ideas of all sorts formed in my mind unbidden, and would lead inevitably to some further expansion of the set of themes that we had organized our lives around. The first day, the voice inside my head suggested that I set out the record I had kept for several years of my I Ching throws, it having been for several years my habit to throw the I Ching at each new and full moon, and to record the throws on a slip of paper which I kept inside the back cover of my copy. At the prompting of the inner voice, I went through this record of throws, looking for an instance when I had thrown the first hexagram. Finding that, I returned to the beginning of the list, looking now for a record of the second hexagram being thrown, and so on. My list of throws covered 3 years and contained about 80 throws and their changes. After about a half hour of this exercise, I had determined that according to my record, I had thrown all of the 64 hexagrams in the 3 years leading up to that moment. This mildly interesting unlikelihood was very significant seeming to me. It proved that I had a kind of secret identity that I was in the process of uncovering. It proved that I was somehow a reflection of the microcosm and had been chosen somehow to be in the situation in which I found myself. I was extremely agitated at this personal verification of the ordered pattern whose design I was discovering everywhere in my life. I composed myself, and then, at the strong prompting of the inner wave of understanding, I quietly burned the record of my I Ching throws. It was a very uncharacteristic thing for me to do.